Welcome to Hometown California, a production of the Rural County Representatives of California, advocating for California's rural counties for nearly 50 years. Hometown California tells the rural story through the eyes of those who live, work, and play in the rural communities of the Golden State. This is Hometown California. I'm your host, Paul Smith. And greetings from Washington, D.C. We are conducting interviews for Hometown California in our nation's capital. We're doing it socially distanced and making sure we all stay safe, as I think hopefully the listeners are as well. If you've been listening to some of our podcasts, you were able to listen to an episode we did about a month ago with the California legislature's conclusion of their legislative session. This is generally the traditional time the Congress wraps up its legislative session. And so we thought we would duplicate those topics and conversations from our nation's capital and talk about what would normally be the conclusion of the 116th Congress. So today we are joined by Cheryl Cohen, senior partner with American Continental Group, and Kevin Eastman, vice president of Pace LLP. Both individuals are very well respected in Washington, D.C. circles. You might call them insiders in our nation's political environment here in the Capitol, but also very, very astute and very well-respected advocates and followers of the discourse that goes on a day-to-day basis in Washington, D.C. Both ACG and PACE are bipartisan government relations consulting firms based in Washington, D.C. RCRC works closely with ACG on federal issues impacting California's rural counties. Kevin Eastman, before joining PACE as their vice president, served on the staff of Congressman Doug LaMalfa, who represents a good portion of Northern California. He did that for a number of years. In his current capacity, he focuses on veterans and defense spending, natural resources, federal contracting reform, and land use issues. And he's been an advisor for the Natural Resources Committee and has deep policy expertise in California water policy, something that's very near and dear to RCRC's legislative portfolio. Cheryl Cohen has been at ACG for a number of years and is one of their founding partners. She works on a variety of issues in her own right. Prior to doing advocacy work, she was the chief of staff to U.S. Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, and also served on the staff of U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, who also hailed from Connecticut. In these roles, she's worked on banking, housing, education, health, and issues impacting women, children, and families. So, Kevin and Cheryl, glad you're with us today, and really appreciate spending some time talking about what's going on our nation's Capitol Hill.
Happy to be here, Paul, and thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Likewise, happy to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
So we're recording this episode today with news less than 24 hours old that President Trump has, in fact, been diagnosed with the coronavirus. And I think it's safe to say, notwithstanding where things are with the 116th Congress, it's been kind of a bombshell walking around the nation's capital with folks really kind of talking about this in coffee bars and even amongst lobbyists and staff on the street corners. So it's been a kind of a tumultuous 24 hours, wouldn't you say?
Paul, this is the second bombshell in as many weeks with the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, changing the dynamic of the election, changing the dynamics in the Senate. And now we have this development with the president. I don't know who can predict what it will mean for the campaign, but it certainly throws a wrench in the gears.
Yeah, and following up on what Kevin said, obviously, this was shocking news to learn about breaking overnight last night. And I think first and foremost, we're all wishing the president and the first lady a speedy recovery. And I think in terms of the Congress, it's already impacted negotiations today. I mean, there's so much breaking news today. Just before coming on the podcast, there's talk about trying to take up a standalone bill to help the airline industry, which, as you know, in the news the day before, was just set to move forward with a number of significant furloughs. And so we've talked in the past, Paul, about things that I call sort of market drivers that can change the trajectory of where Congress is going on something. And up until just last night, we were really at a stalemate in terms of another iteration of a CARES package. And while it's still too early to say how significant events may change the passage of that, just the fact that there's talk about a standalone bill for the airline industry tells you how quickly things can start to move when news like this happens, and obviously additional impacts with the stock market as well as increasing infection rates are all sort of market drivers that Congress is going to have to take into account as they look at where we are today and over the next few days.
Yeah, it's really been unprecedented. I mean, our listeners are going to hear that word over and over and over again, as they probably have for the last, I don't know, year, March, even 4 years, if you want to talk about it in political terms. But normally, this is a time when the Congress is already adjourned. It is October 2nd as we record this. And generally, the Congress has done its budget work or its appropriations work and left town to go campaign, particularly in an even year when we have a general election. But Congress is still here, could stay here for quite a while. So our thoughts of having a 116th Congress wrap is kind of almost premature, wouldn't you say?
I'd certainly agree. The laundry list of unfinished items still hanging out there is lengthy. Of course, we know that government funding was extended temporarily through December 11th. The National Defense Authorization Act has yet to be passed. There's a Water Resources Development Act that has passed in each house but not been enacted, and so on down the line. So what this means in terms of the next 3 months of this Congress remains to be seen. Hopefully, we see additional progress on some of those must-pass pieces of legislation when they come back after the election. But in the near term, I can't imagine there's going to be a lot of real progress on anything but positioning for November.
Cheryl, do you see there being a lame duck, or is that all about November 3rd, or in essence, really November 4th and 5th, or whenever we get a significant amount of results from the election?
There'll definitely be a lame duck after the election. I think right now, I sort of tend to look at these things in small tranches, and especially given how dynamic and changing the events are at the moment. So really starting today, October 2nd through November 3rd, there are two main items on the docket. One is if there can be any opportunity to pass additional relief legislation. And the second, of course, is the Supreme Court nomination that the Senate will take up first at the committee level and then looking to pass that out of committee. I believe they're planning to start the hearings around October 15th with the goal of moving the nomination out of committee on October 22nd. Again, dynamics are changing, but those are the two big ticket items. And you never know what can happen over those 48, 72 hours while they hammer out possibly an agreement on an airline-specific package. You never know what can happen with the larger CARES package. So I would still say that that is potentially still in play, and definitely depending upon sort of what other market pressures come to bear on the necessity for that passage.
And just to keep our listeners fully informed, the conversations about a relief package is really important to counties as they deal with the enormous costs of delivering social services in the COVID era, as well as deal with the significant revenue losses that are occurring in counties across the country because of various economic activities no longer occurring. RCRC has made it a huge priority to try to get a direct funding, flexible funding scheme enacted. And it seems that we're still kind of in stalemate, even though, as we understand, there are conversations going on.
Paul, Cheryl's absolutely right that a second large COVID package is still under consideration. What we don't know is what the president's diagnosis means for the function of those negotiations. He hasn't engaged directly himself in some time with Minority Leader Schumer or Speaker Pelosi during these negotiations. He's relied on Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and, to a degree, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. I'd assume that both of them are tested regularly. I haven't seen so far this afternoon the results of any testing on them now, and what that means for their ability to meet directly with the Democratic leaders in Congress could change the ability of these parties to actually get together for lengthy periods of time and hammer something out.
So with all this activity still left to be done, with the belief that a lot of work can still be done before the election, you've got to have some grumpy members of Congress who want to get home and campaign.
That's a bit of a conundrum, I think, Paul. You've got a number of particularly moderate members in the House who feel strongly that a second COVID relief package would be advantageous for them in November. You have a similar dynamic in the Senate, where there are a number of vulnerable Republican senators who have been outspoken supporters of some of the things you've talked about today, like funding for state and local governments, who need to be out on the campaign trail, but at the same time need to deliver those resources to their constituents. Which of those interests wins in this dynamic, I can't say, but there's certainly a conflict there between the two.
I would agree with Kevin on that assessment, exactly. I guess the only other color I would sort of add to that is, don't forget, voting has already begun in many, many parts of the country with early voting. And one would argue, particularly in this election, which has had so much focus at the presidential level as well, the portion of undecided voters is probably lower than it usually is because of how sort of aggressive and in the forefront the campaigns have been. And so I do think it's a balancing act between members who want to be back and be campaigning. And obviously that's also done in a different way right now. Members are not knocking on doors. They're not really holding the traditional sorts of rallies. So all of that is slightly different, which does take some of the pressure off to be in there because they're simply not doing as many events in person as they normally would do. And you have to balance that with a desire to, particularly for the vulnerable members who are up, to have the advantage of getting something passed that they can go back and talk to their constituents about.
Cheryl, you alluded to one of the biggest things that still needs to be done before basically either the 116th or some would argue before the election, and that is the confirmation to fill Justice Ginsburg's seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. First of all, explain where we are in the process. Obviously, the president's put forth a nominee, but also maybe at the end, talk about where you think the politics of this goes in races for the U.S. Senate and whether that will shape how the hearings will be conducted here on Capitol Hill, and ultimately the timing of confirmation, if there in fact is one.
Judge Coney Barrett has been doing what traditionally nominees do, which is to go and do courtesy meetings with leadership, with members of the Judiciary Committee. Those are usually done in person, where the member and the judge can have conversations and ask questions away from the cameras and before the hearings begin. The judge had been doing a number of in-person briefings with members. There has been talk today about that process and how that process might change to some virtual engagements. In fact, I believe Leader McConnell even alluded to it's possible that the hearings could be done virtually as well, as opposed to in person. So I think some of the structural things are being scrambled today to figure out over the next 2 weeks how those meetings will take place. Obviously, the vetting and the background information gathering that is done by staff will be ongoing. As I mentioned earlier, those hearings were scheduled to begin about October 15th with the hope that they would be concluded and she would be voted out of committee around October 22nd. And then her nomination would be brought to the floor. There hasn't been a lot of question that, again, barring any changes or surprises procedurally, that the nomination can be brought to the floor before November 3rd. It's been fairly clear at this point that Leader McConnell appears to have the votes. I would caution, there are public statements that are made, but there are also members who will go to Leader McConnell behind the scenes and say, I won't come out against you publicly, but I really don't think you should move this nomination before the election. So there are political conversations that definitely happen in terms of how they think moving ahead before the election will affect those races. There's certainly polling out there recently that has said more than two-thirds of the public, about 65%, have said they think that this needs to wait for the next president to move forward. Whether if it's President Trump, obviously he would go forward with his nominee, but if it's another president, that he should make that pick. So I think that the members are factoring all of that in terms of the timing of when the final vote could happen, whether it's before the election or if they decide that they think it makes more sense to do after. I think that still remains slightly up in the air.
Well, actually, I know, Paul, you're doing the interview here, but if I could ask Cheryl, you've probably been through a number of these nominations during your time in the Senate. How does this nomination compare to those that you've experienced in terms of timeline, in terms of public review, in terms of senators' ability to engage with the nominee and really drill down on issues that they're concerned about?
With the preface that I am not a Senate Judiciary staffer by way of my background, I will share my thoughts, I guess, from a macro standpoint. I mean, certainly the timeline to do the vetting and the interview process and the hearings is probably one of the fastest in recent memory. It wouldn't be completely unprecedented, but it's certainly far shorter. I think the average is closer to 60 to 70 days. So it's certainly expedited. I won't touch on the politics of who has the right to go forward or whether it's morally right to go forward. Everyone kind of seems to want to parse and dice the argument to their best advantage of when you have the authority to stop, you stop. And when you don't, et cetera. So I won't really speak to that. I will say, I think the politics around this are really, really high stakes, very emotional. Obviously, Justice Ginsburg was a beloved judge by many, not only on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but by many, and women in particular. There are a number of interesting sort of articles and things that I've read over the last week or so, particularly in the context of the presidential election, and the sort of the vying for suburban women and suburban women's vote and sort of how Justice Ginsburg has been held in regard by a number of suburban women, et cetera, and kind of how that's moved the needle as well. And so I think it's significant in terms of her place in history and moving to fill her seat and all of the dynamics around how her seat would be filled so close to a presidential election, and obviously the history of what's happened before when President Obama had nominated Judge Garland. And so there's a lot of emotion around it as well. And so I think how it unfolds, we will have to see. I think the other really interesting thing to watch is if Leader McConnell does move forward to hold the vote before the election, and if she passes, obviously that opens all the discussion and question around what happens to the filibuster in the 117th Congress and what happens to questions on expanding the court and things that people have started to raise in terms of a counterbalance to what some will have seen an overreach in the extremely quick time frame to get this justice pushed through.
So on the issue of confirmation of judges and bringing it back to the issue of a lame duck Congress, Mr. McConnell, the leader of the Senate, has prided himself in trying to get as many judges confirmed, not obviously just Supreme Court justices. Those come around very rarely, but the entire federal bench, there are still a number of judges and vacancies that need to be addressed. Do you think this whole fight over the Supreme Court will thwart a number of those judges that have been appointed at the inferior level before the closing hours of the 116th?
And Paul, are you asking if some of those judges may not reach confirmation because of this other process bearing out? I think we'll find out very quickly. It's my understanding that in part in response to Senate Democratic lawmakers' procedural efforts to hinder some of the work of the Senate and start to tie things up a little bit, that Senator McConnell filed for cloture on 5 additional judicial nominations this week. So he seems absolutely committed to moving forward with as many as he can, and we'll find out very rapidly whether he's able to do so or not.
So, Kevin, you alluded to the issue of funding the government until mid-December, something that the lame duck Congress will probably have to meet to accomplish because of the expiration of that short-term spending authorization. Do you see the can being kicked into the 117th, or do you see some reconciliation of moving forward for the fiscal year that we are now in?
Well, Paul, I think the can almost certainly gets kicked into the future. The only question is how far into the future. And that's going to depend on what the situation in the 117th Congress and the next White House looks like. Out of the 3 perhaps most likely scenarios I see, President Trump is reelected, the Senate remains slightly Republican, and the House remains Democratic. Vice President Joe Biden is elected, the Senate remains slightly Republican, and the House remains Democratic. Vice President Biden is elected, the Senate goes Democratic, and the House remains Democratic. In those latter 2 scenarios, I think you'll see an effort by Democrats to do a shorter term continuing resolution into around February or so in order to let the Biden administration get its people into place, find its feet, start developing its priorities, and then look to a longer term funding.
Do you see it the same way, Cheryl?
Some ways, yes, and then a few differences. I do think the time after the election when the administration changes hands is always one of the busiest times. Typically, there's a lot of business and work that can get done because the incoming administration, if they can, likes to what I would refer to as kind of clear the decks. If there's pieces of unfinished business that they can get accomplished in December or they can get agreement, they like to do it because they like to start post January 20th and the inauguration of a new president with a cleaner slate, cleaner runway, if you will, to unfold the president's priorities, both from a messaging standpoint and political capital standpoint, and even just bandwidth, right? How much energy and bandwidth there is to accomplish all of those things. So I would tweak slightly to say, under the scenario, if Vice President Biden wins and it's a Democratic Senate, I think there'd be a pretty strong effort to see what could be agreed to in December that they could finish before the year end. If they can't get to a satisfactory agreement from their perspective, they would certainly wait to get what they would see as a better deal post all the members being sworn into the 117th. Keep in mind, typically the president's budget is usually put out in early February, except in the new year of a new presidency, then there is more time. And so all of those different pieces kind of crash into each other in a new administration. Mix that together with the fact that we're not dealing with any ordinary times, but we'll likely have ongoing sort of emergency dynamics from a health perspective that need to be addressed. So the only other thing I've heard is that if they do have to do a shorter term CR and they can't get agreements in December on some of those things, I would probably put the time frame for the CR more into March. I think February is too short a window. They're going to need more time than that to work out some things and also deal with the next fiscal year's budget that the president would have to put together. So I think if there's a short-term extension, it would extend more into early March.
Do you see any scenario that the president is so ticked off after losing, or the Senate Republicans are so ticked off losing control of the Senate, that they could just let a government shutdown occur after December 11th and just say, your problem, see y'all in January if you're still here?
Well, Paul, I can't speak to the president's thought processes, but I don't think the Republican members of the Senate are so irresponsible as to intentionally inflict a shutdown on the country. I think they would work in good faith to find a way forward.
So we've kind of hinted on some of the shortcomings of the 116th. Let's talk about, I think, two of the successes, and love to hear if both of you have additional ones. But it seems that the 116th, for all its frustrations and difficulties, particularly with it being a very contentious election year, did accomplish two things. The first is obviously the initial CARES package that was adopted in March. While there's still some frustration about the rollout of those monies and the scope of those monies, it seemed to have worked, particularly in at least preserving jobs in the airline industry up until yesterday, October 1st, but also getting some financial relief to municipalities and counties that RCRC members desperately needed. Would you say that that was a success?
I'd certainly agree that the CARES package helped to stop the bleeding in both private and public sector across the country. The Paycheck Protection Program kept hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of small businesses alive through a period when they were forced to close their doors. It kept employees on their payrolls during that period and kept them off of the government unemployment rolls. At the same time, it helped local and state governments meet their responsibilities to their constituents by providing health care, supplying PPE, things of that nature, and ramping up their COVID response. What it didn't do was help stimulate the economy and help get us out of that rut. So I think it helped put the brakes on the decline, but it didn't necessarily turn it around to the degree that we might need.
Yeah, Kevin answered that really holistically, really well.
So the other success that many would point out is the Land and Water Conservation Fund, reauthorizing it and making it permanent. Maybe, Kevin, because of your long history in public lands management, you can walk our listeners through what this is and what it really means, particularly for rural California.
Happy to, Paul. The Land and Water Conservation Fund is funded almost entirely by offshore oil and gas leases in federal waters, so it doesn't require any taxpayer funds in order to operate. And when it was initially conceived and authorized, Congress authorized to spend up to $900 million annually on land acquisition and access improvements for federal lands and state and local lands. This is primarily parks. This is community pools. This is acquisition of private land from a willing seller adjacent to a national park to expand it. It's things of that nature. Many people, particularly those who don't live in rural areas, will look at that and say, that's great. Why wouldn't we want bigger parks and better parks and people to have more access to parks? Those who live in the Sierra Nevadas or in other rural areas and are surrounded by federal land have always had concerns that those lands aren't properly maintained. And of course, the backlog at the National Park Service and U.S. Forest Service, I think, is somewhere around $18 or $20 billion combined. I might be a little high on that, but certainly in the over $10 billion. So the Great American Outdoors Act, which received bipartisan support in both houses, permanently approved mandatory spending at that $900 million level for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. So essentially, the money that comes in is going to go right out the door to expand and improve public lands across the country. Recognizing that that was a concern for many Republicans and some Democrats, the bill also includes $10 billion in funds to address the maintenance backlog on public lands across the country. So it touches on both of those points that are a concern. Personally, I think that those Republicans who voted against it, some of whom I'm familiar with and are from rural areas, did so because they thought the funding for the maintenance backlog should be higher than the level that it was. We're talking about permanent funding for the LWCF at nearly $1 billion a year. Meanwhile, this $10 billion would be exhausted, I think, in around a decade or so.
Sure. Would you see this as a victory, or is there still some pause on Capitol Hill about the way this was enacted and its permanence long-term for rural America?
Oh, I very much so see it as a victory. I mean, really, the fact that we're having a conversation that you can count on one hand, bills that actually got done this past year, the fact that you could get enough support for this important bill, I think was a big success and probably one of the very few that we can point to this past year.
Are there any other hidden stuff that we just didn't see make the mainstream media in terms of what Congress accomplished? Obviously, we still have a few more weeks to go, either the remaining days of October or perhaps a lame duck. But aside from that time frame, has there been anything that either of you would point to that says, you know, this got overlooked and didn't really make a lot of headlines nationally, but it's something good that the Congress did?
You know, it hasn't yet been enacted, although I expect it to be, Paul, and that's the Water Resources Development Act. That is not considered a must-pass bill, but Congress for the past decade or so has enacted it on a biennial basis, generally with a great deal of bipartisan support. The big exception to that is 2016, when the Water Resources Development Act included a number of California water provisions and ultimately was opposed by its sponsor in the Senate, then Senator Barbara Boxer, along with a number of Democrats in the House. But after that anomaly, it has gone back to a very bipartisan process. It passed on the House floor by a voice vote this summer. And the Senate version has also progressed down the path, so they do need to go to a conference and develop a final product. But that is maybe one of the few items I would point at and say this continues to work itself out the way it normally has. It's generally non-controversial, benefits communities across the country by improving flood control infrastructure, water supply infrastructure, things of that nature. It's not terribly sexy, so you don't see it on the news, but it's out there and it does seem to be happening.
Others that come to mind for you, Cheryl?
Not really that are big items. I think that there were just a lot of opportunities missed, sadly. And, you know, as we think about preparing for a next Congress, whether it's President Trump or if it's President Biden, one of the things we've been talking a lot with clients about to help them understand is how the process plays out, where ideas funnel up within an administration, how they sort of get vetted. And it's almost, if you will, if you think of it as a cone of decision making that starts very wide on the top with lots of ideas and then kind of funnel down to a narrower area where you make decisions on a political level as to both what's the feasibility of something to be able to be passed and what's the political capital required, what's the sequencing of how you want to unfold those things. And I think not directly to your question, but something worth commenting on, because I think it's going to be one of the lead issues in the next Congress. One of the biggest missed opportunities of the 116th was the chance to do an infrastructure bill, which really is something that there is strong bipartisan support recognizing the importance of getting it done. Obviously, quite a number of differences, both on what are the most important parts of an infrastructure bill and obviously how it's paid for. But I do think that as we go into the 117th, and I can comment on it, particularly under a Biden administration, I do think you're going to see some, getting to Kevin's point about stimulus, I think that as we get into next year in the new administration, looking at an economic package that is not only geared towards sort of immediate relief, but really looking at what's it going to take to provide the stimulus to get the economy moving, infrastructure is going to be a big piece of that. And as you know, Paul, within infrastructure also falls rural broadband and some other really important things for rural California. So I think we're excited to see how that will move forward under either administration.
So we've kind of alluded to some shortcomings. Kevin, I think you alluded to the highway bill being kicked down the road, the proverbial can being kicked down the road to next year. There was a one-year reauthorization of the existing highway bill. But this is something the 117th must address.
Absolutely. And something to keep in mind is that while both houses of Congress developed highway reauthorizations this year, neither provided a means to pay for their proposals. And the House bill was, I think, significantly more expansive than the Senate bill, which is not uncommon, but they were so far apart in so many areas that it's difficult to see how they could have ever been reconciled. I think a lot of people who work in the transportation space anticipated and expected that there would be a simple one-year reauthorization to see how the dynamic in Congress changes next year and hopefully gets to a place where they can reach an agreement.
And to Cheryl's point, there's the issue of a larger overall infrastructure package, which theoretically a massive component of that package would be a reauthorization of the highway bill. Cheryl, do you see that there really will be an appetite to do something bigger than just get a highway bill through?
I do under a Biden administration. I'm not as close to the second term plans under the Trump folks, but I think that an infrastructure bill is a place where a number of priorities can be addressed under kind of the one header of infrastructure. Things as diverse as school reconstruction to rural broadband and traditional infrastructure when we think of roads and bridges. There's a number of really pressing priorities that the country needs and is facing that can be done under that larger narrative. And when a new administration comes in, there's usually always a desire to want to do something in a bigger, holistic way. So I think there are a lot of opportunities to do it. The challenge the country will face on this and other issues is given the deficits and the debt that we're racking up through the COVID crisis. You know, it was already difficult to figure out where you came up with resources a year ago, 2 years ago, when some would argue, I would argue we were already way too high in our debt and deficits. So that's only going to be more challenging. This gets into more of an economist conversation than necessarily Kevin and myself, but economists will debate among themselves the balance between, you know, debt to GDP ratio, as well as the need for stimulus funds in a way that only the government can provide. When the Fed is on the Hill, they're usually very careful in their signaling that there's certain things that they have within their toolbox to help the economy, but there's certain things that are outside of their toolbox that the Congress has and the ability to get more stimulus out there. And my outlook looking into next year is that the need for the increased stimulus is going to outweigh the concerns on the debt at that point, and you're going to have an opportunity to do a larger spending package around infrastructure. The fine-tuned details in terms of exactly where those funds come from and where the pay-fors come from will be the bulk of the work that will need to be done.
And then this will be, I believe, the second closing of a Congress where there has been a failure to pass an energy bill. Do you see anything changing in the 117th? Either one of you see an energy bill getting done in the 117th relatively early?
Relatively early, Paul. I think that would be difficult to see unless there is a massive sea change in the Senate and the White House. It's difficult to look forward and see a significant broad-based package passing so long as we have a divided government, just because both parties have been so far apart in recent history. And I think it's not necessarily that there isn't a desire on both sides to get something done, but that the relationships over the past year have frayed so much that it's difficult to reach a consensus.
I agree. I guess the only other sort of maybe caveat I'd throw out is that there are folks who haven't entirely given up the ghost in thinking that we could possibly get something done in lame duck. I mean, as you know, the House passed their bill. There was some movement in the Senate when they came to agreement on some aspects of the energy bill. The politics of it to move before the election are highly unlikely, especially when you consider this is Lisa Murkowski's purview and given her position on the Supreme Court nominee. I'm not sure that Leader McConnell is looking to move that bill anytime soon. But what is interesting and something to keep an eye on is if the Senate does go Democrat and Vice President Biden wins, sometimes people are more concerned about what may come in the next Congress and they want to get a deal in this Congress. So in other words, some Republicans may feel that what could happen in the 117th under an all-Democratic Congress would be worse than what is currently on the table. And they look to try to move that bill in lame duck. So I think that possibility is still out there.
Well, Cheryl does make a great point there, and we've come back to it several times, I think. But depending on what happens in this election, the lame duck really could be an anything goes scenario. And we just won't know until we get there.
And unfortunately, as we sit here and tape this from what is a relatively comfortable, cool, and somewhat damp Washington, D.C., back in California, the fires seem to rage, and the amount of acreage is just staggering. Most of it, not all, but most of it is on federal land. Where do you see forest reform or something significant and substantial in Congress being done to address what has become a horrific situation for the state of California, and specifically rural California?
Well, we've seen real movement on the part of Montana Senator Steve Daines and California Senator Dianne Feinstein. They've put together bipartisan legislation. It's had a committee hearing in the Senate. That doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a big step in the Senate, which moves very slowly on most issues. We haven't seen comparable movement, I think, in the House. And hopefully these disastrous scenarios that are occurring out across the West, and particularly in California, are going to motivate some members of Congress who've been reluctant to recognize that we need to take a more broad view of forest management. Hopefully it's going to motivate some of them to come to the table.
But Cheryl, do you think that the whole climate change aspect of forest reform overshadows what really needs to be done to address the most acute needs of what the fires represent?
I think this is an issue where both sides really usually have to come to the table to meet on this. It usually isn't a case where just the far more left or progressive are going to run roughshod, because there are a number of members who are a bit more moderate on this and who see the issue more holistically. I also would throw out Senator Ron Wyden, if the Democrats take over the Senate, would be chair of the Finance Committee, who, as you know, being from the state of Oregon, who's also been kind of equally out there on concern related to fires in particular. And I think has had a reasonable approach to trying to address these issues as well. So I think that the compromise can be found on this, and that there'll be enough players in the right places for whom this is a priority, that there'd be some real potential there to move forward.
You touched on something, Paul, I think we should recognize, and that this public focus by a number of elected officials on climate change as a cause or major contributing cause of the fires we're experiencing, that may well be the case. I'm not here to say it isn't, but it is widely recognized, including by environmental groups that many would consider very progressive, that the forests in the West are much more densely overgrown than they have been at any point in recent history. And recognizing that, there's really only one way to address that, and that's removing some of that underbrush and removing those smaller trees. And I think what we need to see is some of those groups more forcefully advocating with their traditional allies in Congress to address that issue.
It seems like it was decades ago, but I have to remind people it wasn't the 116th that this occurred. And that is the impeachment, particularly the impeachment trial in the Senate. In the remaining moments we have, do either of you see any long-lasting legacy from the impeachment trial into future Congresses, or is that just something that occurred then and will probably serve as a footnote in history rather than some momentous change in how Congress operates?
I'll go first on that, having been a Senate staffer in the impeachment trials taking place in the Senate. I think that the tone of the leadership in the next administration and the next Congress will go a long way toward trying to set the expectation. You know, when I worked in the Senate in my very early years, I can still remember, this is in the 90s, when you had Bob Dole and the senator from Maine, George Mitchell. You know, leadership matters a whole lot. It matters in the presidency. It matters in the leadership of the Congress, both in the Senate and the House. It sets a tone for the expectations that the majority or the minority leader have as to how business is going to be conducted, as to how members deal with each other, speak with each other. And we've gone through the last, it's hard to believe, but almost 20 years where we've seen a really spiraling down of that tone and that rhetoric. And I guess that's an optimistic way for me to say that while I know a lot of people think we've gone so far, it can never get back to the civility or where it needs to be. But I would say that the leadership of the next president or in the leadership in the next Congress, and I say that because there could be challenges and there could be leadership changes, and those things can help set the tone. I still hope, and I think if Vice President Biden is elected, given his long-standing service in the Senate, his respect for the institution, his sense of how it can work, I think his basic sense of decency and fair play and listening to others, that tone can go a long way toward trying to bring people together to do some really big things, bipartisan things that need to happen for the country. I know perhaps that sounds overly optimistic in the current environment, but I still hold on to that hope and think that's a possibility.
Cheryl Cohen of ACG, Kevin Eastman of PACE, thank you for your time in letting our listeners have a little more insights about Congress and particularly the 116th Congress. You two are absolute professionals, some of the best in the business, and for us to spend some time with you has been an opportunity that has been very well served. So thank you both. Stay safe, stay healthy.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
You've been listening to Hometown California. I'm your host, Paul Smith. Be sure to check out previous editions of Hometown California to understand and get insights in how rural California intersects with policymaking throughout the Golden State. You've been listening to Hometown California, a production of the Rural County Representatives of California. Subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and be sure to rate and review this podcast. I'm your host, Paul Smith, and thanks for listening.